Well, our third case of the day, State v. Muldrow. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
I am.
Please do.
Good afternoon, Justices and Assistant Attorney General Winters. I'm Attorney Len Kaczynski. I represent D'Anthony Muldrow. D'Anthony Muldrow is currently at Jackson Correctional Institution. He was born in December of 1990. He is now 27. He is on the Lifetime Sex Offender Registry. He's not in prison because of this case. He's serving a sentence, though, arising out of the same case number in Manitowoc County on count two, which is third-degree sexual assault, involving actually the same victim, TJR, but was charged as third-degree sexual assault by the district attorney's office. His release date on that particular offense, which does not include lifetime GPS, is July 3rd of 2018. His maximum discharge date is May 15th of 2022. The GPS monitoring that's at issue in this case would only affect Mr. Muldrow about 4 years or so from now, when he's off of extended supervision and on his 10 years of probation that was ultimately imposed in this case. The Lifetime GPS program was established by Act 431 of the laws of 2005 and effective June 6th of 2006. However, it was kind of was called a zombie law, and that is it was not funded by the legislature until July 1st of 2011. So when Mr. Muldrow committed the offenses in this case, the law was in effect, but not in any sort of program or enforced by the Department of Corrections. The case against Mr. Muldrow was commenced by a criminal complaint on August 27th of 2009, 2 days after he committed the offense on August 25th of 2009. He pled to count one, which is at issue in this case on June 24th of 2010, as a deferred adjudication agreement, sometimes referred to as a DJA in Manitowoc County, where you plead to the offense, but sentence is withheld and there's no conviction unless it's revoked. Well, Mr. Muldrow had the misfortune of committing offenses that caused him to be revoked, and he was sentenced and placed on probation for 10 years consecutive to the prison sentence he's presently serving. Mr. Muldrow had no idea, nor his attorneys, nor the court, really, on June 24, 2010, that when he entered his plea, on the deferred adjudication agreement, or even when the agreement was revoked, that he was going to be subject to lifetime GPS. His attorney didn't tell him, the court didn't tell him, nobody even thought about it as it was at the time of zombie law. It wasn't common practice at that time to inform clients about this law because it was unfunded and unenforced.
Counsel, the central question we have to answer here is whether or not lifetime GPS tracking constitutes potential punishment. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So why don't you give us your best take on why it would be potential punishment. And let me just a couple of embedded questions in that. Is it punishment because of the time and intrusion it takes to service the GPS device, or is it simply that he has to wear it?
All of those reasons combined, like in the decision of Judge Griesbach in the Ballew case, which he decided and was later reversed by the Seventh Circuit, they found that all these intrusions upon the liberty of Mr. Ballew, namely that he had the device on him, it was visible to the public, it was a personal irritant, he had to be tethered to electrical outlet for at least 1 hour a day so the device would recharge,
right,
and so
yeah,
forth.
And you had all that in your brief. So
yes.
Was the Seventh Circuit wrong in Ballew?
In my opinion, it was, yes.
All right. And what is the specific reason it was wrong?
I think the reason is that they followed basically the same factors that Judge Griesbach did in his analysis, namely the factors of the Mendoza factors that were outlined in the brief, except he was of the last factor in particular, whether or not the effects of it were more than necessary for the regulatory purpose. And that is, the lifetime GPS tracking does not directly speaking, prevent an offense from occurring. It simply makes its detection faster than it would otherwise be, because you know where the individual is, and therefore he does not have the offensive alibi, for example.
The reason you're we're asking whether it's punishment in this case is because if it is punishment, then maybe the plea colloquy was bad, and he can withdraw his plea. Isn't that the point of this case?
That's our point. Our point is that much like...
Let me just complete. So we're asking, is it punishment for purposes of plea withdrawal? Of course, you could have... You might answer the question, is it punishment for another purpose? Like ex post facto, something else.
So we're arguing it's punishment for purposes of plea withdrawal.
Right. And I'm not sure that punishment is the same. The definition of punishment is the same depending on why you're asking the question. That's why I'm pushing that this is on a plea withdrawal.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the problem in this case is that if Judge Fox had asked one simple question in addition to those he asked, namely, Mr. Muldrow, do you realize that this plea of yours could subject you to lifetime GPS, that we wouldn't be here today?
That's because he has to advise punishment under 97108.
Correct.
Okay. As well as the general rules about plea colloquies.
Correct. And I think it's the decision this Court faces is kind of similar to that which the U.S. Supreme Court decided when they had Padilla versus Kentucky, that you had to discuss the immigration consequences of a plea with an individual, even though it wasn't set forth in federal law, for example, so that there was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, because the practical effects of deportation or denaturalization are actually worse in many respects than having to spend time in jail or prison.
That was one of the first cases I remember to break from the then kind of rigid rule and distinction between direct consequence and a collateral consequence of conviction. That was in the immigration context. Is there any other example that you can give that would show immigration context in the context of a plea withdrawal, knowing and voluntary? Any other example of what previously may have been thought of as not a direct consequence, because we so circumscribed what a direct consequence was previously?
Correct. I don't believe that there are, for example, the infringement upon Second Amendment rights that occurs upon plea to a felony is something this Court and other courts have consistently held is not something that has to be addressed in a plea colloquy, although a lot of judges do that, and our standard forms do that. Mm-hmm. But I think the practical consequences is what the Padilla versus Kentucky Court looked at, and the practical consequences in this case, as outlined in the facts that were found by Judge Griesbach regarding the GPS tracking consequences on Mr. Ballou, day in and day out, being tethered to this device, is what makes this punishment.
Counsel, I'd like to follow up on a question that Justice Abrahamson asked you. Does punishment mean the same thing in the ex post facto context as it does in the plea withdrawal context?
No, ex post facto punishment can mean something different. For example, I know this Court's had a number of cases involving the DNA surcharge, which for the amount of money it raises, it's caused a lot of cases to come up in front of this and other appellate courts. And $250 is something that you can write off if it turns out to be ex post facto. But when you take somebody's liberty away, like the GPS tracking system does, for the rest of somebody's life, in the case of Mr. Muldrow, probably 50-some years, that's a different situation.
What is the liberty interest that you say is being taken away?
Liberty interest is basically the right not to have government intruding upon you 24/7 with a tracking device strapped to your ankle, having to have it tethered in, having it on you, or the consequences of you taking it off is that's your commission of another offense.
So your liberty interest is not to wear something on your ankle? Is it physical? Is it not to have the government know where you are? Spatially, what is the liberty interest? That's what I'm trying to focus on.
The liberty interest is the right to not have the government know where you are instantaneously, as you are with the GPS device. They know instantaneously 24/7. For example, the sex offender registry statute requires that you notify them if you have a change of address or employer or buy a new vehicle, things of that nature. That's not a terrible intrusion upon liberty. That's basically a paperwork exercise where you send in your postcard or make a call to their toll-free number. But this is something which is on you 24/7, is noticeable, especially in the summer if you're wearing shorts or other clothing like that, and is just an everyday irritant, in fact, literally an irritant on somebody's skin in some cases, as the loose decision by Judge Griesbach pointed out.
Counsel, are you suggesting that the test for determining whether something is a punishment depends on the severity of the consequences under consideration?
Correct. It depends on the severity of the day-to-day consequences on the individual involved.
Hang on. Does the test change, though? I understand the application, that as you apply whatever test we're using, that's going to take account of how intrusive this requirement is. But does the test to determine what is a punishment and what is not a punishment depend on the severity of the consequences? You mentioned that, you know, in the ex post facto context, $250 might be a de minimis thing, whereas wearing a GPS tracker the rest of your life is a really big deal. But isn't the test to determine if it's a punishment the same, whether we're in the plea withdrawal context or the ex post facto context?
The seven-factor test is the statement. In fact, the case I quoted, Radich, was the same as was a DNA surcharge case.
All right.
Well, what is the test? I find that in this there are at least two tests. One is a fundamental purpose test, and the other is the intent/effect test of punishment.
Well,
I don't know that they're different. But if they are, I'd like you to tell me what the difference is, and if they're different, which one applies here?
Well, the state's argued for the fundamental purpose test in its backup argument for its first request. Our position is you have to look at the intent effects test and those seven factors, and that's a more careful way to determine whether or not the effects of a particular provision on someone's liberty is punishment or not for purposes of plea withdrawal.
Counsel, the state has suggested that there are a number of consequences that could follow a conviction of this type that do not need to be explained in the plea colloquy because they do not constitute punishment. One of those is potential Chapter 980 commitment. Do you agree with the state?
I'd agree that Chapter 980 commitment is not something that needs to be gone through in a plea colloquy. Chapter 980 depends not just upon a conviction, but also upon subsequent activity by the defendant after conviction in terms of rehabilitation in prison, psychological condition, a whole new series of due process procedures involved. So certainly 980 is not something, and this Court, I think, has even held that.
Yeah. All right, so there's a couple of others, and I'm going to list them, and then I want you to explain how you thread your way through them to get to your conclusion that GPS tracking is a punishment, but these things are not. So sex offender registration, not a punishment, right?
Correct.
Okay. Restitution, not a punishment?
Correct.
Federal firearm restrictions, not a punishment?
Correct.
Federal health care restrictions, not a punishment?
Correct.
All right. So now tell me, in light of all of those kinds of things not being punishment, why is GPS tracking a punishment?
The major difference between all of those and GPS tracking is that GPS tracking is something that affects the individual subject to it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as long as they're subject to it, which is the rest of your life unless you meet some of the exceptions under the law for getting out of the law. Restitution, there's money there if you don't to pay it. Eventually it goes to a civil judgment. The sex offender registration, I think I've gone through already, so I don't need to go through that.
Let's camp on that one just a second. So sex offender registration is not just a matter of paperwork, I don't think. That has long-term consequences. People know about it, right? And you can make a search for people who are on the sex offender registry. And you can find out if they're in your neighborhood. You can find out if they've applied for a job with your company. You can do all of those things. That seems to be a continuing consequence that goes beyond just paperwork.
On sex offender registry, I have to agree with you. It's certainly more intrusive than restitution or federal firearms deprivation. But that's been held to be on this side of the line of being permissible as opposed to GPS, which is much greater.
So distinguish that from GPS.
The distinguishing factor is that GPS is 24/7 monitoring of somebody's location with conditions on it to make sure that they remain monitored, such as plugging in the unit to recharge and things of that nature in particular. There's also exclusion and exclusion zones, which aren't terribly utilized.
It's the inconvenience.
It's the fact that it's daily, continuous inconvenience, just like being in jail is continuous daily inconvenience, whether it's in a county jail or you're on electronic monitoring.
Being in jail is a little more than an inconvenience, I think.
Well, yes, it is.
So tell me, how do we, if the question is inconvenience, how do we measure how much inconvenience equals punishment?
That's a very difficult issue that depends upon the facts of each individual provision that's being...
Give me some principles, though. How do we analyze that? How do we know when a quantum of inconvenience has hit that magic mark of punishment?
First of all, you look at whether or not it's a everyday, all-day sort of intrusion on somebody's liberty, which GPS lifetime tracking certainly is. You look at whether or not there's any financial consequences to it. There's a slight fee that's attached to GPS monitoring. You'd also look at the issue of whether or not somebody is shamed by it, well, visible the device is or not visible, whether it can be noticed, for example, like a GPS device is, when the central monitor can talk into a microphone and beep or talk to somebody who's on the GPS device telling them their battery's low or they need to contact the control headquarters or something like that. So how visible it is to the general public is another indicator. Certainly the sex offender registry with the Internet is very visible. In fact, I know a number of people that used it for checking out their dates before they went out. It certainly can affect your social life. But this is GPS is even more than that because it's an ever-present thing. And it's also the duration of it. I mean, the duration is lifetime unless you meet the rather hard-to-reach exceptions of the law.
And those exceptions by which you can avoid application, doesn't that suggest that this is not punishment insofar as the exceptions don't relate to the culpability of what's been done, right? It's you move out of state, you become disabled in such a way that you're no longer a threat, or you petition after 20 years and demonstrate it's not necessary for public safety anymore.
That doesn't necessarily show it's not punishment. For example, which you've got, which we have sort of a system of geriatric patrol, a parole in unusual situations, that it's available regardless of the severity of the offense, so there are certain offenses that are excluded from that because they are so severe. So the fact that you can make exceptions to it is simply something that's set up in the system for some flexibility, just like we used to have discretionary parole. And I'll turn it over to my esteemed adversary, Ms. Winter.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Tiffany Winter, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. This case presents the question whether lifetime GPS monitoring for a serious child sex offender is punishment for the purpose of a plea colloquy. But the case is significant because it presents this court with the opportunity for determining what test we use and determining what is and is not punishment in this context. There has not been one test used in all contexts to decide what is and is not punishment. The state is asking...
What is the reason for that, counsel? Why would there be multiple tests?
There's multiple tests because the inquiry is different in each context. So in the Eighth Amendment context, you're concerned with vetting out an illegal punishment. So the test is a little bit different. When you look at something like a DOC denying somebody treatment, that may constitute punishment, and it may be a cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment context, but they don't go through an ex post facto intense effect analysis in order to determine if that is punishment first. They look at it in the context of whether what happened had was punitive in nature and was then illegal because it was cruel and unusual. We also look at punishment in the context of double jeopardy purposes. So if we have somebody who is facing maybe like they have a drunk driving, so they're facing something on an ordinance violation, and they also are facing criminal charges. The test whether the ordinance violation is also punishment is looks at punishment differently than we do in the Eighth Amendment context. And then we have the ex post facto context as well, which is concerned about whether the individual knew or was whether the punishment was in effect at the time the individual committed the crime.
So in the Eighth Amendment context, that's perhaps different because we're not just looking at what constitutes punishment, but what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment.
Correct.
And in the plea withdrawal, the ex post facto, and the double jeopardy, we're just looking at what is punishment. Why would there be different tests to determine the same question?
The state's position is that we need different tests because the remedy is different. So in the plea withdrawal context, the remedy is quite weighty. We are allowing somebody to have their conviction vacated because they weren't adequately informed of punishment. However, in the ex post facto context, if somebody is committed of a crime and there's an ex post facto violation, he doesn't necessarily get to get his conviction vacated.
Right. But why should the severity of the remedy affect the factual question of whether... affect the legal question of whether action X constitutes punishment. Shouldn't we look at that? Shouldn't we evaluate that if we're concerned about the effect of the remedy, establishing additional factors that need to be proved to impose those consequences, as opposed to changing the nature of punishment depending on the context in which we're addressing it?
I think the nature of punishment is just different depending on the context in which you're addressing it, because in the plea withdrawal context, you're fundamentally concerned with whether the plea was entered knowing and voluntarily. And so you're not concerned with the same types of things that you're concerned in the ex post facto context.
Let me push back on that just a wee bit. So when we're in the plea withdrawal context, ultimately we get to that question of whether they should be allowed to withdraw their plea. But as we're going through the analysis, we come to the part that says, was he informed of potential punishment?
Correct.
And you stop there and you say, okay, what's punishment? Why can't you define what punishment is right at that point in the analysis? Why do you need to go on and see, well, I don't know what punishment is until I know what the remedy will be if I decide this is punishment?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, and I may not be, the inquiry in the plea withdrawal context, you need to be specific in that context because you're right at that point, you're post-adjudication. So the defendant has received a substantial benefit from the plea. He entered the plea fully informed of the term of imprisonment that he faced. So the question is whether that he wasn't informed of this thing, GPS monitoring, whether that amounts to a manifest injustice. And if it to amount to a manifest injustice, the state's position is that it has to have an effect on the traditional type of potential punishment that an individual will face when they plead guilty or no contest for a crime, which is the term of imprisonment or fine associated with the offense. In the ex post facto context, a defendant can be adequately informed of everything at that time, but because of the timing of the nature, there is an ex post facto violation. And so he may get relief from what is considered punishment in the ex post facto context because of the timing.
All right. So if I understand your position, it is because of the effect of finding that this is punishment, mm-hmm. We have to calibrate our definition of punishment to match the effect that might occur mm-hmm. if we define it in a particular way. Is that basically it?
To some extent.
So why can't we get at that in a much easier, more straightforward fashion and say, okay, punishment is punishment. But because the remedies are significant in the plea withdrawal case, we say it's got to be significant punishment, right? As opposed to maybe in plea withdrawal, we just say whatever kind of punishment. Why don't you gradate it that way as opposed to changing the definition of punishment depending on context?
Because I think the gradation then necessarily affects the test. So if you're saying that something is punishment in situation A because it is so severe, but not punishment in situation B because in situation B it's not as severe, you're necessarily changing the test then.
Right. So I would suggest you don't change the test as to what qualifies as punishment. And then if you want to argue that there should be a seriousness consideration given depending on the context, okay, make that argument. But I don't get why we would define the same term differently in different contexts when we're still just talking about is it punishment.
I don't know if I have a different answer for you for that. So the state's position is that this court should adopt a simple workable test for the circuit courts that is potential punishment for the purposes of 97108 and the court's mandatory plea colloquy duties is limited to the term of imprisonment or fine associated with offense for which they are pleading guilty or no contest. This is fully consistent with the instructions that circuit courts have been given under the special materials for the jury instructions, SM32, which gives the example of the potential punishment to just be the term of imprisonment and fine faced. It's also wholly consistent with this court's recent decision in Finley and consistent with this court's application of the direct and collateral consequence distinction for purposes of plea withdrawal. So lifetime GPS monitoring in this context is not punishment. It does not affect the term of imprisonment. It does not affect the fine that the individual faced. It is purely a collateral consequence of the conviction. If this court does not want to adopt the state's simple workable rule for circuit courts, we alternatively suggest that you adopt the fundamental purpose test, which is the most consistent with the prior decisions in this area, specifically Dugan and Bollig. So in Dugan, the Court of Appeals was tasked with determining whether restitution was punishment. And the court acknowledged, rightfully so, that nothing fits squarely just in a category of punishment or just in a category of rehabilitation or community protection. We recognize that in sentencing cases as well. When we sentence a defendant, we recognize that there are competing interests at play. Because something will not always fit squarely within punishment or squarely within a different category, we look at the fundamental purpose of the thing at issue, in this case, the GPS monitoring. The lifetime GPS monitoring statute enacted by the legislature has an undeniable fundamental purpose of protecting the community. That is what it was enacted for. It does not prevent an individual from doing any activity that they normally would not do. It just provides community protection by allowing DOC to monitor where that individual is if they need to. I understand Muldrow's argument that he faces grave inconveniences from lifetime GPS monitoring. But even under his proposed test, the ex post facto test, where we look at the intent and then the effects, it's not whether there is an inconvenience. It's whether the effects are punitive, and that those punitive effects provide the clearest proof to override the intent of the statute. And the intent here is clearly non-punitive. So even under an ex post facto analysis, Muldrow could not be successful in meeting his burden to submit the clearest proof that the effects of lifetime GPS monitoring are punitive. The only thing that he has submitted is that they are inconveniences on him. Because they are not punitive, they can't be. It's not punishment. So for the big issue that was presented to this court, whether GPS monitoring is punishment for the purpose of plea withdrawal, the answer under any test is no.
What Counsel, does punitive mean?
What does punitive mean? Well, again, you look at the traditional notions of punishment. So in the ex post facto context, even in the intense effects test, they look at the seven, they have seven characteristics that they look towards to see if this would be something that aligns with traditional notions of punishment. So you're looking at if it's for retribution, you're looking at whether it involves public shaming, something to that effect, if there's a scienter element to it, if there's significant intrusions on individual liberty. But it's not just a mere inconvenience. It has to be punitive in nature.
Counsel, can you help me find the distinction between the fundamental purpose test and the intent effect test? It sounds to me like the fundamental purpose takes the punitive intent element for the intent effect and then grabs maybe elements 4 and 6 of the effects test.
So the traditional punishment retribution, yeah, and then the connection with the non-punitive purpose.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, I think that's accurate. So the state is asking that the court take Dugan and Balig and reconcile those cases, because in Dugan, they just looked really to the fundamental purpose, and then in Balig, they looked to the fundamental purpose and then whether there was something to question that fundamental purpose. And I think the best way to reconcile that is to say that the fundamental purpose test is an objective test. We don't just look at the subjective intent of the legislature when they were enacting the statute, but you look at the objective application of the statute at issue. And when you look at the objective application, it should be clear whether that is punitive and not based in something else like community protection. But the objective application of the GPS monitoring statute supports that it is for community protection and that it is not punitive in nature.
And those in your alternative test, fundamental purpose, you use purpose instead of intent.
Mm-hmm.
In the ex post facto, it's intent slash effect. Is there a distinction to be made between purpose and intent?
I don't believe so, no. I believe they're the same. So again, the state's position is that under any test that this court adopts, the lifetime GPS monitoring statute is not punitive, unless there's further questions from the court. Thank you.
Address whether or not it's a direct consequence?
I don't believe it is a direct consequence because it is something that's imposed by another agency. And the court has no play in whether GPS monitoring will be imposed or not. The court in sentencing an individual can't exempt them from GPS monitoring. The decision to place monitoring is solely within the hands of DOC. And it's not solely based on the crime that the individual is convicted of. To be eligible for GPS monitoring, there's also other elements that have to be met. So you have to be convicted of a particular crime, but you also, the sex crime against the child can't be a crime against a relative. And it also has to involve some use of force or threat or harm. So it's not simply that I was convicted of first-degree sexual assault of a child or second-degree sexual assault of a child. It has other elements to it, and the decision is made by DOC and not the court.
And the DOC has discretion on whether to apply the lifetime GPS monitoring requirement?
If the crime meets all of the elements, there is no discretion to apply it. So once it is imposed on the individual, they can make the determination after the individual is off of active supervision to use the what they call GPS tracking versus passive tracking. And then after 20 years, the individual can petition the court to be exempted from it. And then DOC also has the ability to petition to exempt somebody who is incapacitated and not a threat to the community.
If you meet the requirements for the mandatory imposition, it seems to me that gets awfully close to a direct consequence.
It does seem very close to being an automatic result of a particular plea. But even in the direct and collateral consequence distinction, we're concerned with whether it is a direct or collateral consequence on punishment. So if there is a direct consequence of a conviction that is not punitive, it's still collateral because it has to be both direct and punitive.
And in assessing the punitive nature of a direct consequence, what is the test?
There hasn't been a test that has been uniformly applied by the court. So whether they were looking at the sex offender registry in Bollig, that's where they kind of used a limited intense effects, or in the firearm restrictions or the health care restrictions, there's never been a well-articulated, this is the test that we use in this context for direct and collateral consequences, which, again, is, I think, the import of this case. It gives the court the opportunity to articulate what test we use for the purpose of plea withdrawal when we're concerned whether something is punishment in a direct consequence. Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of Mr. Muldrow, I think that this court's primary requirement in this case is to determine and make sure that if someone like Muldrow enters a plea, that it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. The statute that's determines eligibility for lifetime GPS, namely 301.48, defines everyone for a child level 2 sex offense that's involved sexual contact with somebody under the age of 16 to be required to have this, so that it's not necessarily discretionary. Individuals like Mr. Muldrow that are still in prison perhaps don't present a lot of sympathy to this court, but I have other individuals who may have committed sex offenses against children dozens of years before and then get convicted from somebody making a statement and later and the defendant making a confession later on to the offense where they are found subject to it. They're on community supervision. All of a sudden, surprise, their lawyer didn't tell them they're on GPS monitoring. I've had that happen in cases, and I think I've referred to that in my brief that could happen to individuals as well. I think that the intent effects case from Mendoza and Martinez that were utilized by Judge Griesbach and Ballew is the appropriate test because it enables the court to consider the circumstances of any particular type of consequence in addition to fine and period of imprisonment as to whether or not it's punishment. I think clearly GPS tracking is punishment. It's a direct consequence if you meet the criteria in 301.48 paren 2, which outlines who is covered by lifetime GPS. I think if somebody enters a plea to a level 1 or level 2 child offense, as it's defined in the statute, and then they really should be allowed to know or should be informed that it's not only going to result in possible fine and imprisonment, but also it's going to possibly result in them having to have their liberty curbed for the rest of their lives because of lifetime GPS. I think that the statute is clearly punishment in effect, even though the intent of the legislature may have been simply to provide greater protections for children and other citizens. But the consequences are so severe for this particular sort of consequence that it's not just like sex offender registry. It's not like deprivation of federal firearms laws or a payment of restitution as a condition of probation or even without probation. Clearly, I think that a plea cannot be knowing, intelligent, or voluntary if they're unaware that they could be living with this 24/7 for the rest of their natural life. And that's it may be 5 years before Mr. Muldrow is out on the streets and subject to this under his other sentence that he's been serving yet. But it is significant not only for him but for others similarly situated that are convicted of sex offenses but don't realize that the consequences are not just being on the sex offender registry for 15 years of her life, but for this as well. So for those and all the other reasons we've stated, we ask that this court reverse Mr. Muldrow's conviction and enable him to withdraw his plea so that the consequence he is not subject to sex offender registry until and unless he's found guilty by a jury or enters a plea and is properly informed of what the effects of that plea are actually going to be for him.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So this concludes our argument on State versus Muldrow. The court will meet in closed conference at 20 minutes before 3 o'clock. We are adjourned.